Justice Malala is one of South Africa's clearest voices when it comes to breaking down the intricacies of our politics and our politicians, as well as our place in the world. He joins me today to talk to us about what we should be looking at, as he says, the good, the bad, and the ugly of South Africa as we head into the second quarter of 2025. Making it through all of the traffic and all of the, I truly appreciate, as always, I appreciate having conversations with you. And I think our listeners appreciate more than anything your clarity of mind and insight. So
thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And this, for me, is we are in the second quarter of 2020. Five. Mm. Believe it or not, it's just give that Christmassy time.
Yeah,
so, first half of the year, Christmas here in South Africa, we're like about to have holidays on holidays on holidays. But it is also an opportunity, I think, to kind of take a moment and say, as the second quarter starts, we've already had a hangover first quarter. Start. And so I never know where to start, but today, I think, in light of Fikile Mbalula's interview last night, maybe a good place to start, and we know some of your feelings from your tweets, about where the ANC finds itself in this flux with their GNU partner taking them to court. With their founding documents of their partnership, with somewhat opposing statements from the deputy president of the ANC about their partners and the secretary general. So what the hell is going on?
Thank you, Pumi. It's amazing. You know, there's good and there's bad and there's ugly in the past 10 months of the life of this monster and this beautiful thing that is the GNU. The good and something to celebrate is that we are here. And you made me start thinking when you talk about time. You know, this GNU is just over 300 days old. When we started off, it looked so far apart. It looked so fractious. You think, this thing won't last 6 months. Okay. So it's just over 9 months. It's heading for 12 months. June 14 is, just two months away. And it's
exactly 2 months.
Exactly 2 months away. So it could just get there. And it could fall apart. But I think this is a cold shower for the GNU in general. It's a big cold shower for the ANC, a long one. Because I don't think, one, that the ANC actually believed that there is a GNU. The ANC believed that it pulled in a bunch of people to say yes while it governed and governed the way it's governed for 30 years. The ANC even today does not believe that the DA, Patriotic Alliance, all the partners, the IFP, all of them, FF Plus, deserve have a say in how this government should be run. The ANC believes, even at 40%, when it doesn't, it's not near a simple majority of 50% plus one, that it's still in charge. And so it believes it can just go through. The way this budget was done was essentially, once again, the ANC saying, we are in charge, we're not going to do this. So I think celebrating the 300 days of that GNU, it has to be said right from the onset. If you look at the numbers, the ANC has 40%, the DA has 22%. If you take those two numbers into the GNU and say, let's form a cabinet, the DA should, by a simple calculation, have about 10 ministers, It went for six and it accepted. The ANC goes ahead and says, I've already signed the NHI. You have to accept it because that stuff from the past administration, the DA kills over and says, fine, we can go on. We will do other things, but we can go on. The DA basically betting that, oh, you know, Discovery Health and other healthcare providers, private healthcare providers will go for it and will fight that battle. And so the ANC wins and wins and wins and wins. Come budget time, we have a deputy minister. We have two deputy ministers of finance, David Masondo and Ashok Sarupan from the DA. All along, you see the Minister of Finance and the Deputy Minister of Finance from the ANC SACP, David Masondo, you know, talking and doing this. It's almost like the Deputy Minister who comes from the DA doesn't exist. Only 2 hours before he gives his speech, the minister says, I'm going to hit the public with a 2 percentage point VAT hike. That is massive.
Do you truly believe that it was only then that this thing was?
Oh no, the ANC. Some people certainly in the ANC knew, but he thought, oh no, we'll just go
ram
for
it through.
And what is extraordinary for me is that Mamoloko Kubai, who was the head of economic transformation in the ANC, did not know. She was the first in that cabinet meeting to say, Bofwet, what's going on? This is for all its faults and for all its actions, the ANC has always stood up as the party of the poor. It was the party that was going to bring in and brought in a massive social wage through paying grants and so forth and so forth. For the ANC did not raise VAT between 1994 until Malusi Gigaba in 2018. And it was so painful at the time. But there was a reason that many of us, including me, said, okay, you know what? We stole money hand over fist during the state capture years. We need to plug the hole that was appearing in our finances. And so he said, go ahead and do it. But this time, in this economic climate, how does the ANC justify that?
So, which brings us to now the DA challenging the constitutionality of the minister making this unilateral move, right?
Yes.
So, and now I think for the first time, a lot of South Africans are hearing the smaller machinations of this thing. Well, the first is the fiscal framework, and then it is this bill, and it's appropriations, and this, right? And the DA says, well, I'm going to challenge the constitutionality of this thing. So in flipping the script.
Yes.
Is the DA now fighting on the side of the poor?
Not particularly, no. But on the matter of the... So I've been interested in Deputy President Paul Mashatile's stance. He says, if I was a member of the DA and a cabinet minister from the DA serving in Cyril Ramaphosa's cabinet, I'd be ashamed to pitch up for work and say I'm working here while I do not agree and oppose the budget to the extent of taking it to court. However, I would be ashamed if I was a member of the African National Congress to be a part of an organization that says I stand for the poor, to be the one that's saying I'm going to take money from the poor so that I can fix my mistakes with this budget, with our finances in general. Remember that in 2008, when Thabo Mbeki was fired by the ANC from the presidency, our debt to GDP was 28%. We are now at 75% going on 76%. We basically, after Thabo Mbeki, Trevor Manuel, left the building, it was, hey, Bafwetchi,
with money in the bank.
We have money in the bank, and we're going to borrow more. And it just went from 28% to 30% to 35%. At 45%, the warning lights should have been going off. No one said anything. At 55%, no one said anything. Now we were heading towards being Greece, where you're going bankrupt. No one said anything. We went to 60. We went to 70. Only now it's like, oh, where are we going to get the money? And we're going to steal from the poor. So the DA, to answer your question, isn't the party of the poor for me, but actually it's standing up for something that is good for my mother, for my sister, for my relatives, for my friends in Hammanskraal who go shopping and now have to put more in there. And you know, this whole thing about, no, we're going to extend the basket of items that are zero rated. Oh, come on. It's not like, what's the point of introducing a new tax and saying nothing belongs in that? Even if you say that, the middle classes, like the people in this room right now, the middle classes.
The precarious middle class.
The precarious middle class, absolutely precarious. The precarious middle class and the precarious black middle class in particular. At the end of the month, you're taking groceries to Mama Lala. You're taking stuff. You still have a lot. This idea that you're not hitting the poor is ridiculous. And I'm particularly disappointed. I'm a big fan of Enoch Godongwana, the finance minister. He comes from NUMSA, the most pro-poor trade union when it was still in COSATU and out of COSATU now. For a minister like that to instinctively go for that for poor people, say what you will, I you know, it's interesting. It's not just the DA that's saying this VAT is absolutely outrageous. It's people in the ANC. It's people outside of the ANC. It's every single party out there. It is extraordinary to me that the ANC, and I blame the ANC, has brought the GNU to the point of collapse for something that even they, they claim they don't believe in.
So this raises two questions for me. Being a soccer fan and happy today after the weekend, has the ANC, literally as they say in soccer, given the DA a sitter? Are they going to score a goal here that will see them in the next election bump up their support?
I think it is a sitter. It's an own goal. The ANC has dribbled itself into and passed the ball to its own keeper and, you know, poor guy has fallen over and it's behind the net. It's extraordinary for me that the ANC has done this, but it does this at a time when it has been consistently from 62% under Zuma to 57% under Ramaphosa to now 39.8%. All the polling, you know, there was a time in South Africa when you say, oh, you know, these people are biased, da, da, da. You know, Social Research Foundation, all these people who do this stuff. This election in May 29 last year showed us that actually the polling was pretty damn accurate, almost to a percentage point. They're all showing the ANC going to below 30 at the moment. And the ANC, in my view, has an opportunity. You know, I wish I was a political operative, one of these guys who go around saying, I will run your campaign for you. Because for the ANC now, if the ANC stayed in the GNU, the ANC can do two things with the GNU. It can say, I'm sorry, I can't do 1, 2, 3 because you see, I'm with the DA now.
My hands are tied.
So it doesn't have to do the populist stuff like, oh, we're going to give massive increases to their civil servants as we've done for 15 years straight. Okay. You can say, no, this year we're going to have to stay because, you know, we are constrained. Mm. At the same time,
austerity.
Austerity. And then you can say, on the things that we do need to do, like, you know, we can't have all these regulations because Pumi wants to invest here, but we're making her do this and do that and 20 different forms that let's make it easy for money to come in and da-da-da. Open this thing up so that, you know, we can have people reopening, shut down factory places like Babelegi, where I come from, or Roslyn, and so forth and so forth. You can do things using the GNU's cover, and you can implement and make things efficient. And people love the ANC in this country. I always say the thing I bemoan is that are the people who didn't turn up to vote last year. And I think a huge chunk of those people are the people who say the ANC has lost me, and they don't know how to say it's okay to go and vote for the IFP or someone else.
But I think just that is indicative of how much the people no longer love the ANC.
Yeah.
The fact that they won't come out to vote, the fact that they couldn't convert all these first-time voters to come out, I think it's indicative that people actually no longer love the ANC. But do they love whoever else is out there enough to give them this boost is the bigger question.
Well, I mean, that's great. And that's a fantastic argument. And it does turn the coin on the other side, because then if I am Musi Maimane or Action SA, I've got to ask myself, what is it that people are not seeing in my outfit to give me more than 2 seats in parliament, to give me more than, you know, I was amazed last year, and I think we had this conversation offline about how Songezo Zibi's party was doing such an amazing job of postering. There was nowhere in South Africa. I went to my grandmother in Tzaneen. I went to the further south in the Cape. I went all over. And everywhere there was Songezo Zibi staring at me. And I thought, this guy, you know, he's
Utori wants her something.
Utori wants her something. And I'm still trying to work out.
He's going to pull up my case.
So the point you're making is that self-reflection among those parties, what is it that they're not tapping into? Are there controversial issues that we, particularly among the middle classes, that we perhaps are not talking about? I found Gayton McKenzie's campaigning absolutely shocking. The stuff I stand against and I'm opposed to, and I hate the sort of xenophobic campaigning that masqueraded as, no, we love South Africa and so forth. But is it that, you know, Makashule Ghana, who is a fantastic campaigner, and his people at Rise Mzansi, did they fail to see this, that this is an issue that ordinary people are now saying, what is going on in my country? So I think that self-reflection, I don't know if it's been done. I don't know if it's been done enough. But people are not loving, they might hate the ANC. They're not loving the other.
Well, and speaking of the self-reflection, we don't get to talk to you enough. So I would love to hear what your view is on, can we still say young Julius Malema? But we can say the young EFF.
Yes,
the young EFF, which came in as a voice, a supposed voice for young people, a home, new, fresh, blah, 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 and yet decline.
You know, can I just say, I followed Julius Malema for years and years. I've, you know, when he was in the youth league, and then he hived off into the EFF with Floyd and others and so forth. I think the story of the EFF goes further back. I think you know, you and I, we could talk a lot about the PAC. We could talk a lot about AZAPO. So the Black Consciousness Movement and the Africanist sort of streams of the liberation struggle, how they were connected very much to the rest of the continent, and the messages, you know, Steve Biko's philosophy of Black pride, Black self-reliance, that idea of rising above the definition of white actors, their definition of what Black liberation should be and Black protest should be. So Julius Malema's traditions and the EFF come from that. And I've been writing a lot about the rest of the continent outside of South Africa. And what amazes me, and I think is an incredible victory achievement for Julius Malema, is that you go to Sierra Leone, and there is an EFF there, and there is an EFF MP. You go to Kenya, and Julius Malema is speaking, and the hall is full of people who are moved by his messages of Black pride, Black self-reliance, and so forth. They've just put in place the president in Namibia. In Namibia, there is an EFF. All over the continent, in weird places, in Nigeria, you find the EFF, and it's not just it. It almost feels like a movement rather than it's the Julius Malema EFF in South Africa. That's an organization that's very tightly controlled by a very controlling leader who doesn't brook any pushback. As we have seen. So I do want to say that Julius Malema touched off something on this continent. And I think, you know, there's interesting politics going on. If you go to Senegal, for example, the new young president, I think he's 44, came in last year. And he is implementing a program that says, the minerals in this country, they are rich in oil. They have other mineral deposits. The way it's evolving is essentially that we have to start empowering our own people, and we can't be looking to France to always be telling us how our economy works and so forth. That entire coup belt with Mali and Burkina Faso and so forth. But those politics, and you listen to those politicians, it's almost like you're listening to Julius Malema and the EFF. And I'm not saying Julius Malema is solely responsible for it. I think it's an idea whose time comes and leaves and comes and leaves, and it's been doing that for a while. So outside of South Africa, I'd say Julius Malema is quite a powerful ideological or perhaps even intellectual force. But influential. These ideas are percolating elsewhere outside of South Africa.
I think that's interesting, because one of the things that I found fascinating over the weekend is watching Mbuyiseni Ndlozi in Malawi.
Yeah.
And what degenerated there with Bushiri is a different conversation. Yeah. But the fact that here in South Africa, this party... And I disagree with you on some of that ideological stance, because I don't think that they are truly steeped in ideology or pass on that ideology. If you talk about the Steve Biko's and, you know, Sobukwe's and the ideology underpinning what their movement was about, lest we forget that Julius Malema did not hive off but was expelled.
Fair, and then needed
an outlet, needed the next thing. And so this formation became, not from, unlike Esobukwe, who ideologically decided to leave the ANC. You know, so I think, and watching also what's happening with him here and the decline they've had in the last election, which I think is going to continue declining for a while. I don't know if he can keep this going because it's not steeped in ideology, but rather in personality cult.
I think the personality is so powerful and so divisive and so off-putting in many, many ways. Those of us who've been on the receiving end of being called names by Julius, of being told that we are this or that and so forth, know just how destructive that element of him can be. I would disagree with you. I think the ANC, whether it's 1976 and those young people protest against the education system, find themselves in exile, become ANC members. But ideologically, a lot of them, people still say, ah, yeah, that Siya came from the Kile Zimzim, you know, it's from that ideological strand still exists in the ANC. And so I think people like Julius have left the ANC and taken that on because in many ways it does have a radicalism that's beyond the ANC's very liberal, neoliberal stance of the post-1994. I think people like Thabo Mbeki expressed some of that, but within a framework where they also had to govern in a very complex environment. I think your Jacob Zumas just took it because it sounded nice. And it gave them, it was a populist ploy to say, oh, look, I'm more radical than thou, and I'm better than you because I can call the white, I can call the men names and so forth and so forth. But I do think that either by mistake, by, you know, out of his control, the EFF has taken, if you look at some of the younger leaders in that EFF, and maybe they might not be, you know, your Sinawo Tambos and others, they might not be able to grow that party. But they are not there, in my view, because solely of that. I think there are products of the Fees Must Fall movement, which was animated by some of those ideas. I mean, it's a post-colonial movement in a way that I think Yombuyiseni Ndlozi, who has left, I think what animates them is not, it's not the personality cult only, although the personality is cultish. And to your point about the decline will continue, it will continue because the personality now supersedes some of those ideas that many of those young, particularly the student activists, the fallist movement types, came into the EFF for. So yes, I think intellectually it's a bit rickety right now. I mean, Julius looks lonely and sad at the moment, and it's not a good look in politics, quite frankly, to look exposed. And every time he holds up, you know, his rambling press conferences, you feel sorry for him rather than feel like, gee, he's really talking truth to power. You know, he's not the firebrand of 2014. It's hard being 11 years old, leading a party that signed up more than a million people. I think perhaps he needs to think about, you know, what interests me about Julius is this thing that what happens to the founder when what happens to Herman Mashaba? Does he stay until he gets into power? Does Julius stay and say, I'm the founder and da, da, da? What if you've started a movement and it becomes bigger than you? How do you step back? And it's a question for Bantu Holomisa. It's a question for we haven't found a way to transition from the founder to a party that can continue and hopefully even get into power. Tony Leon wasn't the founder of the DA. He took over from the DP and other sort of liberal
broad parties.
But he left, and Helen Ziller came along,
and she's still there.
That's another question. She, in a way, you know, we talk about the GNU today. Are we talking about a participant in the GNU led called the Democratic Alliance led by Helen Ziller, or are we talking about a GNU led by John Steenhuisen? Oh. Because right now, I'm very interested in the fact that every time I'm looking for a bit of sensible input about the GNU, I can't go to, and your first question when we started was about, you know, you referenced Figile Mbalula. You know, it's Figile Mbalula on the one side and Helen Ziller on the other, shouting and you know, almost, you know, trying to kill each other. And then, you know, there's Cyril Ramaphosa and John Steenhuisen sort of in the middle. John Steenhuisen turning up for work despite, you know, the lawsuit, you know, and so forth. So it's who am I talking to?
And speaking of pandas, we would be remiss not to speak of that other party founded by the one and only Gedleyi Hlekisa, Jacob Zuma.
Yes, indeed.
Because the ruckus that they've created in the body politic of South Africa, in going from launching on the 16th of December to contesting and essentially becoming the opposition party in May. It's quite a thing.
It's extraordinary, and it's. I mean, it also offends the sensibilities because you ask yourself, this is a man whose administration for 9 years, we can quote chapter and verse. What was unemployment like when Jacob Zuma started? It was at 20%. What was it like when he left? It was 25%. How were we doing on the Millennium Development Goals? We were here and we were there and so forth. How were we doing on corruption? Where were we on the Transparency International Corruption Index? We were up there when we started off as in we were good. And then we are absolutely in the doldrums when he left. All those things. We had the Zondo Commission and so forth. And yet millions of South Africans voted for him. Despite all these things, more than 20 years of controversy, of scandal, of incompetence, of corruption allegations, all sorts. So it's an amazing thing. It's an incredible thing. And you've got to give it to Jacob Zuma.
So do South Africans like the personality of cult?
Parts of South Africa parts of South Africa love cults. I think that Julius Malema is almost a sort of biblical figure. I will take you to the promised land. Jacob Zuma, yes. I think Jacob Zuma has a rawness to him that says, I'm Samson. Let's bring these walls down. And there is an element of anarchy in the South African psyche that says, yeah, this not working. Let's just
bring it all down.
Break it all down. I feel that in the makeup of that party. It still does not have, even with Floyd Shivambo being Secretary General, it doesn't feel like it's got structures. It doesn't feel like it's even got a coherent center. And yet it continues to win, you know, by elections here and there. It's preparing for the local elections. I'm caught between where is it gonna go, And one part of me says, you now have Duduzile Zuma Sambuja in court. There is nothing in politics and in South African politics better than a victim card. And so the fact that she's been charged for her participation or her egging on incitement of those riots in July 2021, you know, she'll be in court. And if you go back to Jacob Zuma in 2005, Jacob Zuma was charged with corruption and then was charged with rape. And those court appearances became rallies for Jacob Zuma to win the ANC presidency in 2007. And he's used even today his court appearances as a rallying point to say, you see, they, and you never know who they are exactly, but they are doing this to me. It's the clever barracks, it's the this, that. So I think there is something powerful around the trials and tribulations of Duduzile Sambuja Zuma. I think there will be some value there. Jacob Zuma will continue to do what he does. On the other hand, many, many people will say, wow, how many treasurer generals has this organization has? You know, I think that we are on number 9 now.
I lost count. I stopped counting because...
exactly. Who actually is in this? But you know, for me, the biggest concern is here's an organization that has absolutely said the founder is God. Because in Jacob Zuma's party, if he says, justice, you're gone. There is no, even as he goes to the ANC and says, you're violating your constitution, you've got to follow this rule before you can fire me. In his party, Jacob Zuma has fired more people in his party since it started in December 2023 than the ANC has fired in its entire life, probably.
That we know of.
So you know, that founder is still powerful, and I think the local government elections. The ANC is, you spoke about a sitter in football. The ANC is giving not just the DA or others, but the MK party a sitter as well. Because quite frankly, at local level, you know, we talk about potholes. The city of Johannesburg, it's an absolute disaster that's run by the ANC on and off over the past 10 years. And people look around and say, wow, you know, Tshwane is running a great PR campaign. Is it running a good city? We can have that debate.
Well, there are fires in Tshwane. They are like tires alight on the street in Tshwane because people haven't had electricity since the 3rd.
There you go. So the ANC isn't there to fill that gap. And so I think others will step in. But I think we set for more coalitions than... In the short to medium term, than straight governments where a party wins, but the ANC will continue to weaken. I don't think the ANC is doing the things that are needed for it to perhaps return to over 50%.
Well, as fascinating as only looking at our home politics, South Africa also. It's just a small speck at the foot of Africa. Mm. But it's also a fulcrum, kind of trade routes, as we see now with all of the mess happening with the Houthis. Mm. There is, when we pull out, a big world order that's also shaking up in a lot of different ways. And small as we are, we have all this attention from Donald Trump. Mm. And his trusted advisor, Elon Musk. Mm. And you've been closer to the antics of Washington than we are. What are the news from across the sea? what are the people thinking, saying, what are the papers that we are not seeing over here? Because we see the big things. And thankfully, we also see Donald Trump's tweets.
Yeah.
But what else is in the ether in the US about South Africa?
I think there are two things that we South Africans have to really, really think about very seriously. I was interested in, is it Lawrence Wong, the Singapore Prime Minister? I thought his message to the people of Singapore last week, a week and a half ago, was incredible. And he said the world has changed and it's going to be painful. And he was speaking particularly on the tariffs, but I thought the message was bigger than that. It was the world is changing, the world has changed, and we've got to find a new balance in this changed dynamic. I think South Africa is still almost reacting to world events or to U.S. events and to January 20 when Donald Trump was inaugurated as president in a way that says, oh, we can do things the same old way. I think the world has changed fundamentally. It is a world that looks at South Africa and says, you know, you and I have been sitting here and we complain a lot about this country and how, oh, this isn't working. It's like, oh. But there is something that happened in 1994. We went from 46 years of apartheid rule to a full democracy, to a constitution that the world, including Supreme Court justices in the U.S., have said, this is the constitution. This is how you rebuild.
A blueprint
for a new country. So we operate, you know, we criticize Ramaphosa. I don't go to jail. We do things in a certain way. We are an open democracy. We're a vibrant democracy. And we expect that the world loves us because a good, beautiful thing happened in this place. An amazing thing, an improbable world event took place here when the oppressor stepped down after huge pressure and a big fight. And ordinary people took over. They elected the ANC, and we had a dream of a country with all its faults and all our criticisms and all our, you know, whatever we say about Cyril Ramaphosa, Jacob Zuma, and so forth. But it's the country. So there was no question about what 1994 meant until now. Donald J. Trump looks at 1994 and sees it as the rise of DEI, as he would call it. You know, it's the rise of wokeism. South Africa is, in essence, it's anathema. It's the polar opposite of what the U.S. administration that's in power now things of a country. And so every week since January 20, there has been a tweet, there has been an executive order, there has been a tariff declaration, there has been an insult, there has been a boycott, there has been something. This weekend, as you and I start the week, as you say, you know, it was that, how can we go to South
that
Africa?
That tweet was outrageous.
It's outrageous.
The amount of time and energy put into constructing that tweet, that video, that all of it showed me how much machinery is behind this onslaught that we are in.
The machinery, but the animus, the total, the ability to hate, and to hate on the basis of lies. You and I are sitting here in Johannesburg today, and we are being told that in this country there is a genocide, and he repeats this lie. When even the people he says are being killed, I say, no, it's not a genocide, but we want to leave. That's okay, they can leave, but this is not... There isn't a genocide. So So I think South Africa needs to be very clear-eyed about what this is. This is just the beginning. We're only 2 months down from January 20. And
4 years.
It's 4 years.
4 years of Donald Trump. Exactly. If we're lucky, it's 2 years till midterms, and maybe his power is tempered, if we're lucky. But 4 years of Donald Trump.
Yeah. And so I think South Africa, the first thing is to really, South Africa needs to think hard about how it takes up a stance that will protect it, its people, its economy over the next few years, because this isn't going to stop. Sending Park Steyn, nice man that he is, to Washington, D.C., and expecting that he'll get a hearing that's more respectful than what Solidarity and AfriForum get, it's naive. This administration is going to lecture him. It's going to tell him he's bad, and it's not going to do anything that he says should be done. It may be a stance that South Africa takes, but I think South Africa needs to be thinking very strongly about other ways of engaging with the U.S. Outside of, Park Steyn said in the press conference he held with the Minister of International Relations, Ronald Lamola, that, you know, we need to understand how the number, the 31%, 30%, 31% tariff that was imposed on South Africa was reached.
35.
And I thought, well, that's sweet. But quite frankly, you know, no one knows how any number was reached. But the South African number, we are the one country, as the tariff bad guys list was being read out, that was accompanied by, oh, the bad things are happening in South Africa. Bad things are happening down there. What bad things? We know there are no bad things that, you know, the president of the U.S. can quote, but there you have it. So I think this is a time to seriously think about what this relationship looks like, where it's going, because it's not going to change. I don't think the hits that South Africa is taking. I wasn't surprised that Donald Trump says, why should I go to South Africa for G20? It was to be expected. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, has already said it.
He never came.
He never came. So Trump is not going to come to the summit. If he comes here, he'll come here to just shout and tell us that we are an SS whatever country and all that kind of stuff. So South Africa...
Can we rely on our BRICS friends, considering Modi and his posture,
mm-hmm.
and then how he has responded
yes.
to the Don? Mm. Can we rely on our BRICS friends?
No, I don't think so. I think if you look at what Russia is doing, Russia is very much in the Trump sphere of influence, or Trump is in the Russian sphere of influence. No one is going to be saying, Vladimir is not going to pick up the phone and say, "Oi, Cyril, do you want me to have a word with..."
So no de-dollarization.
No, it's not going to happen. As you say, Modi is doing whatever he can for his own country. It's me first. So he's doing India first rather than America first. China... Perhaps that we could, you know, I mean, economists, you know, the Wandilesi Shoppers of this world can tell us better. But we'll probably need to continue to diversify our exports to places like that. China is the only country in that list of countries hit by these tariffs. You know, China is standing up. China is saying, we're going to fight. China is saying, we've been around for 5,000 years, so we'll, you know, we've got longevity, we've got stamina for this. But no one's coming to save South Africa. South Africa has to, in a very complex world, has to find a way to do for itself and for its people what needs to be done.
Can our president do it? Do you think our president wants to do it? Is he in the job? Is he driving? Is his mind in the game?
That question is really a question about everything rather than just the US.
Yeah, it's about our president.
Yes.
And the fact that he is the CEO of South Africa Inc. Mm. He is making, or we understand him to be the person in charge of making the decisions, steering the ship, mm. holding the GNU together, mm. sending, deploying Parks Tau. Mm. You know, that's what he is. And this man was sold to South Africans mm. as this brilliant strategist, businessman. Look what he's done in his own personal life. He is the CEO we need for South Africa Inc. Mm. And I'm asking you, as he is almost a year into his second term, does he have what it takes?
I don't think Cyril Ramaphosa has what it takes. I think that Cyril Ramaphosa has lost it. He is 1 year into his second term, but remember he did a year. He finished a year of the Zuma term. He did 5 years of his own term. So he's 7 years in office. 7 years is a long time to execute your strategy to deliver. He's had knocks, yes, COVID-19. But quite frankly, right now, if the president was serious about fashioning a response to the massive global changes taking place, he would be very resolutely making sure that he's not spending his time solving issues about the GNU. The budget fiasco was totally his fault. That you table a budget that you haven't spoken to your coalition partners about, and that you end up having your coalition partners and the opposition and everyone else around you saying this is a massive mistake, it shows someone who's out to lunch. He's not present. President Ramaphosa right now should be saying, what kind of coalition did we build and what kind of coalition are we going ahead with? That coalition should be a strong coalition. In my view, it should be an ANC-DA coalition that can make decisions. They might not agree on everything, but if they agree on a set of principles and a set of actions, they implement those with vigor and they go ahead with it. Right now, the ANC is sitting in Sandton negotiating to get rid of the DA and sit with the PA, IFP,
Action SA,
and a whole bunch of small parties. Let me tell you what happens in that scenario where you have the ANC at 40 and a gaggle of others who make up 10%. One of them, our good friend Gayton McKenzie, says, you know what? We need Kenny Kunene to be a minister. And we're not going ahead. We're not approving this budget ourselves now if we don't get that. So while Cyril Ramaphosa says, Kenny, come and be sworn in as the deputy minister of sport. Someone else, Velenkosini Hlabisa, says,
I'm not happy here.
You're not happy. You haven't delivered for the Zulu King. Okay? So you're running around fixing that problem. Mm-hmm. Every one of those mangle moose of parties will have a demand, will want it satisfied, because now you've taken power and given it to 8 different small parties instead of having one partner. Yes, you're suspicious of them, you're competing with them, but one partner that you can say, look, let's agree that we are going to say for any business that wants to establish here from the US, like Starlink, Elon Musk, who we might hate, da da da, we will say it's not BEE, but it's what Solim Alatsi may be doing now, and that is communities, education, a cutoff of this is what we can do that goes into dealing with a problem that we have, and it's our past. Right now, who are you going to talk to about that carve out? You know, I mean, it's a joke. So Cyril Ramaphosa has spent the past 2 months, while South Africa is facing the biggest economic risk, it's an economy. 600 American companies operate in this country. 600.
200 of whom have already either expressed, since the beginning of last year, either expressed their move out of South Africa or began to move out of South Africa. 200 out of those 600. Say.
So here we are.
That highest unemployment rate in the world.
That is what we should be dealing with. We're dealing with, no, we don't like that these guys don't like VAT, which we also do not like. So what is, you spent 2 months from February 20 when we are supposed to have. Let me tell you, this is one thing, you know, I miss Thabo Mbeki so much. I tell you, Pumi, one of the things about Thabo Mbeki was that, you know, for me, it's the small things. If you say we're going to start the meeting at 10 o'clock, you start at 10 o'clock. The minister every year from 1994 until this year, the Minister of Parliament arrived at the end of the last Thursday of the second last Thursday of February. The Minister of Finance arrives at 2 o'clock, stands up in the National Assembly and delivers a budget. This year, we have the extraordinary sight of a South African, the powerhouse economy of this continent. The minister says, oh, are we not ready? We are cancelling. You know, just there are fund managers all over the world saying, what are the South Africans going to say? What's the economy going to look like? And suddenly it's like they can't table it because the guy hadn't spoken to the opposition. He didn't know there was a coalition.
Ooh, what a picture you paint. And a dire one, which I think I think many of us know that we are in a dire situation. But the way in which you've painted all of these various threats is quite illuminating. So in closing, I'm going to ask you a yes or no question. And then if you can rein yourself in to not give any justification for your answer, I'll be happy. But if you must give us a justification for your answer, I'll give you 60 seconds.
Okay.
Even in all of that chaos, is Cyril Ramaphosa about to be the first president of the ANC and the country since Nelson Mandela to finish his term?
Yes.
And you want to say?
Because the ANC is in a bind. After Cyril, everyone that is in the running just looks even worse. So they've got this trump card that's also losing its sheen, but it's the only one they've got. So they've got to keep him and keep going. So that's it.
Well.
That's a hard answer to give.
But really, thank you. Thank you. It's always so fascinating to have this conversation with you.
No, it's like great fun. Thank you so much.
Because it can be everywhere and anywhere. but always so illuminating. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. It's good. Thank
you. Yeah, we might bring you back for the third quarter.